Today, I am going to tell you about certain effects connected with orbital degrees of freedom in transition metal oxides mostly, but in principle, not necessarily oxides. And in particular, in interesting effects connected with frustrations in this situation. And by frustration, actually, I mean actually, in this case, two things. First of all, it turns out that when we consider what can happen with orbitals and orbital ordering in different situations, then even in lattices, which are usually treated as simple, like, say, simple cubic lattice, we do have, it turns out that we do have rather strong frustrations already. So that frustration in the first sense, so to say. But second point, and actually it will be probably the main part of my talk today, is that, as you know, people now are very much interested in systems with geometric frustrations, with rather complicated lattices, like, say, pyrochlore lattice or Kagame lattice, or maybe to less extent, triangular lattice. It's maybe somewhat less frustrated, but still, it's frustrated lattice. And people always considered until now, as far as I know, behavior of different spin systems on geometrically frustrated lattices. But there are some materials, some interesting real materials, in which we also have the geometric frustration in the lattice structure. And the ions, which are sitting on these frustrated lattices, have not only spin, but also orbital degree of freedom. So the question is, what would happen with all the story of orbital ordering in geometrically frustrated lattices? And actually, my interest to this problem was again raised by some real experiments. In particular, there is one material about which I will just speak a lot. This lithium nickel O2, and also similar material sodium nickel O2. It's a whole class of materials, and I will explain later how they are made. But it's actually a rather important class of material, even from technological point of view, because to this class of material also belong, for instance, lithium cobalt O2. And that's a material which is basis of lithium batteries, rechargeable batteries, which you can buy in stores, actually. That's made using this one. And people are now trying very hard to use, say, for instance, also lithium nickel oxide, because lithium manganese oxide, I can also add here lithium MnO2, just to substitute cobalt, because I don't know all the details, but people claim that, first of all, cobalt is much more expensive, and then it's toxic. So they're trying to make batteries with good performance, but a bit cheaper. But I am, of course, interested mostly in physical properties, and that's actually material which attracted quite large attention already from 70s, immediately after Anderson suggested his idea of resonating valence bond, RVB, because as I will tell you later on, it's kind of anticipating. This material has a two-dimensional triangular lattice with nickel having spin 1/2. And Anderson, when he suggested this RVB, it was exactly two-dimensional triangular lattice with spin 1/2. And people immediately started to look at this material as a maybe possible realization and manifestation of RVB. But there is much more as to this story. But I will start by something else, and I will start by reminding you, probably most of you know most of the story about orbitals, but still it will be convenient for me just to start from the beginning and also explaining why frustration appear even in simple lattices if we are dealing with orbitals. Now, okay, so what are we dealing with? We are dealing with, for instance, for simplicity, 3D ions, which have L equal to and 5-fold degenerate orbital levels, LZ going from plus 2 to minus 2. And if you put them in, as typically these transition metal ions are sitting in octahedra coordination, and if it's regular octahedra, then this famous crystal field splitting in two. Triple degenerate T2G level and double degenerate EG level. And then, depending on the number of electrons which we have here, we can sometimes have situation with filled subshell, but sometimes a situation when we have one electron, for instance, in this band. For instance, manganese 3+ has 4 d electrons, and they are filled according to Kuhn's rule 1, 2, 3, 4. And this fourth electron does not know which orbitals to occupy if it's regular octahedron. And another, maybe even better known example is copper 2+, that has configuration D9, and that has only one hole, so it's this is all filled. And there will be one hole, and again, if it would be regular octahedra, it would be degenerate. And then we all know the famous Cantellar theorem, which tells that this situation with orbital degeneracy, for instance, double degeneracy as here, is unstable, and system always can reduce spontaneously symmetry to leave this orbital degeneracy. So if I make, say, for instance, this octahedra tetragonally elongated, then there is further splitting of these orbitals, for instance, like this, for instance. And this will be the square orbital, which has the following shape. And this will be this famous x square minus y square orbital, which is always important for cuprates. This is filled, this is all filled. And this will be this x square minus y square orbital relevant for cuprates. But in principle, there are many systems in which there exist several phases. In cuprates, for instance, in high tissue cuprates, it's like this, with this initial splitting from the very beginning, so to say. So in the whole region of existence of this solid, of, it's always like this. But there are many materials in which there exist phase transitions. Say high temperature phase is, for instance, with regular octahedra, for instance, say cubic for simplicity, and with decrease in temperature, there exists structural phase transition with reduction, with decrease of symmetry, and with distortion of this octahedra. So in high temperature phase, I have equal probability, equal occupation of both these orbitals. And in low temperature phase, I have a situation when at each particular site, one particular orbital is occupied. And that's why we can use different words to describe this phenomena. We can speak about orbital ordering, or we can speak about cooperative Yanteller effect, because on-site effect, single site is Yanteller, if it occurs in cooperative system in the whole crystal, it's cooperative Yanteller effect. Now, I will mostly speak today about situation with this degeneracy, one electron or one hole in EG band. In principle, these are ions, typical ions in which it's important. And another ion which I will again speak about is nickel 3+. If you just consider, say, chemical composition here, it's plus, it is 2 minus, so nickel formally is 3+, in this case. Also, by the way, manganese is 3+, so manganese is also would be Yanteller ion here. But why nickel is Yanteller ion? Nickel has configuration D7 in principle. But nickel is not in high spin state, as we show here, but nickel is in what we call low spin state. Because of rather strong crystal field splitting, nickel prefers to occupy 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 goes here. So it is configuration which is T2G6, EG1. So you see that this subshell is completely filled, the same as it filled in copper, so we can forget it. And here we have, so it's in a sense, it's electron counterpart of copper in that sense. In copper, we have one hole in double degenerate band, spin 1/2, and double degeneracy. Here we have one electron in EG band, one electron, spin 1/2, and double degeneracy. So it's a situation with spin 1/2. And there is also double electron degeneracy. So I forget about these states in most of my talk. And how do we describe this situation? We have 2 degrees of freedom. One of them is spin at the site I, And another, I have also doubly degenerate orbital states, and I can introduce convenient description introducing this pseudo spin at the side I, so that, for instance, pseudo spin z equals plus 1/2 correspond to orbital 3z squared minus r squared, or I will simply call it, say, z squared orbital. That is just this orbital which I show here. And tau z equal minus 1/2 would correspond to orthogonal orbital, which is x squared minus y squared orbital. And shape of it is, okay, I can just also draw it here. This is this copper orbital. So I have 2 degrees of freedom to describe each ion s in tau. And I can do the same game as we always do in standard strongly correlated systems. And I consider today only situation with integer number of electrons per side. For instance, one electron or one hole. One electron would be just nickel situation, and one hole would be situation in many cuprates. And I can start with Hubbard model. And if there is strong correlation, and if my effective hopping is smaller than on-site Hubbard repulsion, then I can always go to using perturbation theory to effective Hamiltonian, which would, in this case, describe exchange interaction, but it will couple not only spins, but also orbitals. That's one.
Why is the degeneracy not lifted in this case as opposed to copper?
Well, as I said, that if I have regular octahedra, then the degeneracy is there. Degeneracy may be spontaneously lifted by distortion. No, it will. But it will actually be one of the main problems, in which cases it does lift, in which cases it does not. That will be essentially, in a sense, the main topic of my talk today. But actually, I wanted simply to first to introduce you this description. And then I just wanted, right now, I wanted to tell you what can happen in this situation if I consider a concentrated system. Now, maybe if you ask about distortion, I may, before going to exchange mechanism of ordering, I may also tell you about this electron lattice coupling. You see, here I told you that I can lead the degeneracy by distorting the lattice. It means that actually what happens here is that I have to include electron lattice coupling, and then this electron lattice coupling finally would give me certain distortion and certain occupation of particular orbitals. How does it work? I can just write down my effective electron phonon Hamiltonian. I won't use it later on mostly, but just for completeness, I will just represent it here. This will be, no, that's actually, this will be Jahn-Teller, but not dynamic in strict sense. Because by dynamic Jahn-Teller, usually people mean that we have to treat also phonons completely quantum mechanically and go to, say, mixed vibronic states and so on. And then there are a lot of complications even on the level of single side ion. I will mostly speak about something like mean field treatment of this problem, which ignores part of quantum effects in this vibronic sector, so to say. But what I want to say is that I can just write down some effective Hamiltonian, which will be, for instance, C dagger 1, C1 minus C dagger 2, C2. Then by 1 and 2, I denote this different. OK, maybe I'll just reproduce it somewhere here to keep notation. So it's number 1 and number 2. Two values of pseudo spin, up, down, if you like, but in pseudo spin sector. And then this will be a coupling like this, and times some distortion, time phonon distortion, say B dagger plus B. That, of course, will be at site I, distortion at site I. Here it should be Q minus Q. And actually, I have to be more careful.
sum over I and momenta. And then I can, as usually, in usual case, I can exclude my phonons and go over to effective Hamiltonian, which it's like in superconductivity, excluding phonons and obtain effective four fermion interaction. But here you see that this is actually the same as tau z, because if I have, for instance, tau z equal plus 1/2, I have occupation of this one. That will mean that this is 1 and this is 0. And if I have occupation of this orbital, if this is 1 and this is 0, then it will correspond to minus 1. So it's essentially tau iz. And I have also to introduce actually another term, plus a term which will be C dagger I 1 C I 2 plus Hermitian conjugate times other phonons. In any case, after I make this exclusion, I obtain effective Hamiltonian in terms of these pseudo spins, which will have a form of something like, say, J I J tau Z I tau Z I tau Z J. And maybe something from here, this will correspond to, say, tau X in this case, plus something else. And my J I J will be of order of, say, J squared divided by phonon frequency omega. So that's standard exclusion.
You can't get terms tau X, tau X, tau
In this case, not. If I only include electron lattice interaction, then lattice in first approximation only couples to orbitals, because different orbital occupation means different charge distribution. That couples to distortion. It's different. Actually, I must also say that if I have these orbitals, I create effective quadrupole moment. If I have equal occupation of both orbitals, my ion is kind of spherical or have cubic symmetry. There is neither dipole moment nor quadrupole moment. If I have particular occupation of orbitals, I have now quadrupole moment at each particular site. So in a sense, actually, this is a third term which I can use for this orbital ordering. One is orbital ordering. Another is cooperative Antelier effect. They simply stress different aspects of the story. Orbital ordering, it means that I tell you which particular orbitals are occupied at each site. When I say that it is simultaneously cooperative Antelier effect, I stress this physics, this mechanism of ordering, because that's a coupling of orbital degrees of freedom to the lattice and combined distortion of both. And I can also say that orbital ordering simultaneously means creation or existence of quadrupoles at each particular site. So it's simultaneously also quadrupolar ordering. So my real order parameter will be really quadrupole. And actually, there exists similar phenomena in some rare earth compound. And in rare earth compound, actually, because of very small radius of corresponding wave functions, coupling to the lattice is rather weak. And exchange coupling, which I will speak about in a minute, is also rather weak. And people usually are speaking about quadrupolar ordering in this particular case. For instance, there exists a quadrupolar ordering in uranium O2 or in, say, cerium B6 and so on. In many of these materials, rare earth materials, there exists similar phenomena, but it's known under different name, under name quadrupolar ordering. But actually the same physics, but simply people stress that there are several different mechanisms which can lead to this reduction of symmetry. And in rare earth, probably a real quadrupole-quadrupole interaction is more important, and that's why people are using this terminology.
What's the next term in the way that your blue dots? Hmm? What's the next term in this expansion? You said there are dots. What's the next term?
Well, next term, I mean simply that actually, if I have doubly degenerate electron states, they interact not only with one type of phonons, but with several types of phonons. And in particular, it also interacts with doubly degenerate phonon modes. And one of these phonon modes coupled to tau z, another couples to tau x. So actually, in simple case, I may have terms containing tau x, or sometimes even tau z, tau x. And that's actually what I will just tell you in a minute, because that's actually the reason of frustration in orbital sector. But it's easier for me not to go into all the details in this sense, but to explain it more or less qualitatively. Why is that? And what kind of frustration, what kind of terms will I get here, for instance, due to electron lattice coupling? Suppose I consider a situation when I have two Jahn-Teller ions sitting here and each surrounded by oxygen. So I have a common two octahedra having common oxygen, common corner. And suppose I now just make distortion like, so occupy orbitals like this here, so that what it will do, it will push its electron cloud. So it will push negatively charged two minus oxygen in this direction. So it will be local elongation along that direction. Then physically it's quite clear that it's not favorable then to have also local elongation in neighboring side. If I have local elongation here, pushing this oxygen in this direction, it's not favorable to have local elongation here pushing in this direction. So in the neighboring side, it will be better to have contraction in a simple case. So it will be better than to have, say, for instance, orbital like this. So it means that there will be kind of anti-ferro coupling between orbital occupation and neighboring sites in this particular situation. When I have oxygen sitting in exactly in between this oxygen. That's what we call 180 degree bond. So metal, oxygen, metal angle is, well, crudely speaking, 180 degrees. It may be also slightly tilted because of, slightly changed because of tilting of this octahedra, as very often happens in perovskites. But still, it may be okay, maybe 170, 160 even, but reasonably close to 180. In this case, I may expect that for this pi pair, I will have, if this is site I, this is site J, I will have coupling of order of J, tau zi, tau zj with a sign plus. This will be my interaction. And it's indeed so happens if I just do everything carefully, I indeed obtain just this particular term, very simple Isaac interaction for this particular pair. So in contrast to standard spin situation, I don't have here scalar product SU2, S dot S, but I have Ising type interaction, not Heisenberg like. But situation is not so simple. And that will be the one of the main reasons of frustration I told you about. I may also have situation when I have, say, for instance, a situation like perovskite. I have magnetic ions here, but also magnetic ions here along Z direction and along X direction. Now, from point of view of this pair, they want to occupy, for instance, these orbitals and this one. But from point of view of this pair, this X is not worse than this one. Then from point of view of another pair, they would rather prefer to do something like this. And this orthogonal orbital which look like this. So the fact that I have in simple situation like perovskite X, Y, and Z equivalent will tell me that actually I may work not only with this orbital, Z square, X square minus Y square, but I can also rotate them by 90 degrees, and it will mean that I have to work with X square orbital, and orthogonal will be Y squared minus Z square, and they are as good as these ones, or with third one, Y squared, and orthogonal one will be X squared minus Z squared. In principle, when I'm dealing with such a spin state, I can, of course, always take any arbitrarily linear superposition, like spin-north. Make spin-north with theta, which will be in this basis. It will be, say, cosine theta over 2 and sine theta over 2. Or it will be cosine theta some z square, or theta over 2, plus sine theta x square minus y square. I better write it's theta. So I can have any linear superposition of these two orbitals. For simplicity, if this real coefficient, in principle, there may be also something interesting if coefficients are complex, but that's a separate story. I won't touch it today. But for real coefficients, so what it means? It means that I can represent each of the states on such a plot. Then, for instance, I put tau z here and tau x here, and this state, this will be my theta angle. So this state would correspond to the square orbital. Orthogonal state will correspond to x squared minus y squared. But there is equivalence between z squared, x squared minus y squared, all three axes. And in this plot, it is reflected with the fact that this system should always respect a kind of threefold symmetry in this state. This is, will be angle 120 degree. This minus 120 degree. So this orbital will then correspond to x square, and this to y square. And this will be, okay, it's 60 degree, it will be a sandwich between x and z, so it will be x square minus z square. So all my Hamiltonian would should respect this symmetry, that if I obtain solution like this, I can also obtain solution like this and a solution like this. Now, interaction. We just explained that for the pair along z, my effective orbital interaction, my effective orbital coupling, this tau Hamiltonian, has a form of j tau zi tau zj. But it's not everywhere, but only for the pair when ij is parallel to z-axis. For the pair parallel to z is tau z, tau z. But for the pair parallel to x-axis, I should substitute it by kind of what happens with these spin orbitals, spin operators, when I rotate it by 120 degrees. So, and we can say that if this is tau z axis, then you can easily understand that this will correspond to minus 1/2 operator describing this state will correspond to minus 1/2 tau z plus square root of 3, the sine and cosine tau x. So this combination will describe this state. And this combination, minus 1/2 tau z minus square root of 3 over 2 tau x, will describe this state. So when I want to write down, I know how this term looks for in cubic pair of sky, for instance, for this pair, that is this term. But for this pair, I have to rotate it, and then I will have sum over ij now parallel to x. And here I will have this combination, by half tau z plus square root of 3 over 2 tau x, and at the side I, and the same combination, minus 1/2 tau z plus square root over 3 divided by 2 tau x j. So you see that Hamiltonian is rather strange. It has Ising term in this direction, but it has a different combination of operators in x and y direction. And that gives rise, that all occurs because of this fact that in contrast to spins, orbitals have particular shape, particular orientation in a crystal. So in that sense, when we are speaking about spins, then x, y, and z axis in spin space have nothing in common with x, y, and z in real space. And here they do. Tau z in this orbital subspace, in pseudo-spin subspace, knows what is z orientation in real space. And that gives rise to frustration. And I can also explain it rather simply in a model which, well, we came across this model quite a long ago, and actually only recently there was some progress in this model made.
Can you, may I interrupt
you shortly? Oh, sure, any moment.
This diagram you have up here, I got confused. You have written x squared minus y squared at minus 1. Shouldn't it have been up at I 0?
Sorry, once again. No, I write down again this state.
You have it in an EG system, where you could choose your axis 3z squared minus 1 or the other one. So my confusion is where do you put the state x squared minus y squared?
Yeah, you see, this is actually, this is definition of state.
I agree.
This is definition of state. If cosine theta is equal, if theta is equal 0, then z squared state.
I can live with that, that's fine.
Okay.
And I'm just saying, to do that up on the graph.
To do this on the graph, okay, maybe it's too crowded, I will just reproduce it again.
No, it's all right, I just want
No, that will be a bit easier. That's theta equals 0. Sorry?
Some cosines and some theta over 2. Right?
Well, depending on whether we are dealing with this spin state or the corresponding distortions, usually that's actually.
No, Daniel, I mean, you're writing up a state here. Yes, now you could just take the one.
Here I write tau z in the direction tau x.
That's all, isn't it?
Sorry?
You have two states, and you can either put them like this or like that.
Yes, but I can also make arbitrary linear combination, and the shape of corresponding linear combination, if theta is equal to pi over 3, will correspond to the state 3x squared minus r squared. And if I have theta equal to minus 2 pi over 3, then you can simply make this transformation and see that it corresponds to 3y squared minus r squared. And all three states initially in cubic crystals should be equivalent. This means that state here, and state here, and state here, in principle, should be equivalent.
My only question is, what you call tau x is the whatever creation operator for x squared minus y squared.
No. That's creation of a mixture, of equal mixture.
Okay.
As I said here, what I call tau z equal plus 1/2, this is my z square orbital.
Yes.
Tau z equal minus 1/2, this is my x square minus y square orbital. This is relation. So both these orbitals,
okay,
they live on z axis,
yes,
on tau z axis.
Fine, thank you.
And this is tau x is actually a mixture, creates equal mixture of this orbital. Square root of 2, of some of them. So it will be not any clear orbital. It will be a kind of, has three different lobes in different directions, generally speaking. Now, again, simple model to illustrate this situation. Here it's a bit more complicated because I have only two independent independent operators, tau z and tau x, so to say. But suppose I just have three of them independent, and I make a formal model like this. And this model, you can just illustrate yourself. Why I call it compass model. You go to the shop and buy 100 compasses if you have enough money. And you put them, say, for instance, like this. And then we know that they interact by dipole forces, and they want to form something like this. Correct? Simple thing. And this will be described by this kind of interaction. Pair along that axis, they form to do something like this. If I have, forget about this chain, and make chain along x, they would prefer to order like this. And then interaction along x will be, again, the same j. Well, in this case, for compasses, it will be minus j. It will be ferro coupling. It doesn't matter. It will be tau x. But for the pair along x. And for the pair along y, I can have interaction tau y, for simplicity. And so my toy Hamiltonian, maybe like this, toy model, which is rather funny theoretical model, will be like this. Will be, say, j, maybe positive or negative. Sum for the pair parallel to z, tau z, Or I can even write just simply S here, if you like, or sigma. That sigma Z plus, for the pair parallel to X, I have sigma X, plus, for the pair parallel to Y, I have sigma Y. Seems to be a rather simple model. It has Ising form for each particular pair, but for different directions, different combination, different operators. And then we immediately can understand that if we have, say, two-dimensional or three-dimensional system, we may be in trouble. Because, say, for instance, this guy, what to do? From point of view of these neighbors, it wants to look like this. From point of view of these neighbors, it wants to look like this. And then classically, if I treat them classically, I can have, for instance, ferromagnetic ordering in with arbitrary orientation, so that, for instance, I have as z equal to, say, sine phi and as x equal to, or sigma here, sigma x equal to cosine phi. And then if I sum over these operators, I see that each of them have two neighbors along z, two neighbors along y. So my mean field energy will be j or minus j times sine squared plus cosine squared phi. It doesn't depend on phi. So you see that it looks as though system has some continuous rotational symmetry. And indeed, if you just do this and calculate, for instance, your excitation spectrum, you found out that it's gapless, like Goldstone mode. Although actually each particular term in this interaction is Ising, so there is no continuous symmetry. But it's kind of reproduced and restored or quasi-restored when we are dealing with cubic system in this case. And that's funny situation that, contrary to standard wisdom, when we are used to think that three-dimensional systems are usually ordered, but 2D and 1D, they have much more tendency to be disordered due to Merman-Wagner theorem. Here is just the other way around. One-dimensional system would be perfectly ordered, but 2D and 3D will be disordered, in a sense, or maybe disordered, maybe highly frustrated.
Is there a way to coarse grain this a little bit and then map it to some more well-known Hamiltonian?
Well, this is rather simple Hamiltonian. I don't know what is simpler.
So that this continuous symmetry will be manifested in Hamiltonian?
No, there is no continuous symmetry. That's actually the point, that on the level of classical treatment or mean field treatment, it looks as though the system indeed has here this extra degeneracy, so to say, or Goldstone mode. And it will turn out later on that, well, if you have time, but I hope I will, that in the more realistic models like these ones, there will be even situation when indeed on this level, the spectrum of excitation is such that if you calculate fluctuations, they diverge. Even. And that gave rise to some ideas which first were expressed by, in 97, I think, by Feiner, Olesch, and Jan Zanen, that they expected that in this case we may even have a liquid state, spin orbital liquid state, or maybe pure orbital liquid state. But that's actually a big question. There was a big debate in literature, and on one side there were these three gentlemen I mentioned, Feiner, Olesch, and Zanen, claim that there will be a spin orbital liquid state. And on the opposite point of view was mostly defended, expressed by Khaliulin and Udovenko, who claim that it's not the case. It is only this degeneracy exists only on mean field level. Then there may be order from disorder phenomena. So we have to go beyond mean field approximation. You have to calculate fluctuations. And then fluctuations on top of different types of ground state may be different. And then if you want to really calculate your total energy beyond mean field, you have to include zero-point energy. And zero-point energy for the whole manifold of states which are degenerate on mean field level, but different ground states may have different fluctuation spectrum, and different zero-point energy. And then this zero-point energy chooses maybe one particular ground state, or maybe only three particular ground state, x, y, z, and so on. This will be this famous order from disorder phenomenon. And that was the claim that, for instance, in this model also, there exists this order from disorder effect, and system will choose, going beyond mean field, will choose one particular ground state. And in this particular ground state, if you then calculate correctly the excitation spectrum with the fluctuation taken into account beyond mean field, there will be a gap in the spectrum. So this gapless excitation will disappear. They only exist on mean field level. And that's exactly the case which we also obtained for this particular situation. It will be a bit more complicated, but physics will be like this.
What kind of fluctuations do you have in cloud to get a gap?
Well, that's actually mod-mod coupling, essentially. In diagram language, for instance, these are diagrams like, for instance, this extra diagram or these diagrams and so on. Yeah, we start with these modes which are gapless, which are in this case orbital waves like spin waves. And then you go beyond mean field, you include these kind of diagrams in calculations, and you obtain one particular ground state, and the gap opens in this spectrum. But in principle, there are also some problems with this order from disorder, because formally speaking, you may justify it for large spin when you are close to classical limit. For spin 1/2, it's again, most probably it's right. We do believe that it's right. But it's still a question, actually. So it should be probably addressed only numerically. And there are some attempts, actually, to solve this model now more accurately numerically. And there are some preliminary data that maybe it's not as simple as I said. What I said, it's actually not completely trivial, but still outcome is relatively simple. One particular ground state, and this pseudo-Goldstone degeneracy is lifted, and gap opens in the spectrum, and so on. But it may be more complicated than that. Some preliminary data, which I simply heard some claims, but I've never seen anything. Okay, I now already explained how can I get something like frustration in a pure orbital sector. And now I want to go to a more realistic model. A more realistic model should include, in my case, not only orbital degrees of freedom, but also spin degrees of freedom. And I already started telling you something like this. So I have T to G level, which are completely filled. I have EG level, which has, for instance, one electron, spin 1/2, and orbital 1/2. And I consider a situation when I have one electron per side with strong interaction, strong correlation. So what I can start with? I can start with Hubbard model, which is minus, say, T I J C dagger I sigma C J sigma. But in this case, I have also to include orbital index. It's not only spin plus minus or up down, but also orbital number 1, 2. So I include this alpha in beta. When alpha and beta are 1 and 1 and 2, or the same as z square and x square minus y square. Or I can also go to different bases, if you like, but I choose some particular basis. And what is also different with respect to standard Hubbard model, usually we treat this T as constant. But here, this T effective hopping would depend on that particular type of orbital. So it will depend on alpha and beta. That's exactly what I just told you already about. Say, for instance, if I have tau z equal plus 1/2 here and plus 1/2 here, it means that I have these two orbitals. And these two orbitals along that direction overlap very strongly. But the same two orbitals, even the same two orbitals, but along x direction, overlap 4 times weaker. Or x square minus y square orbitals, they overlap rather strongly in this direction. But, for instance, if I have two orbitals like this, we can neglect this overlap almost completely. Very, very weak. Or if I have, for instance, pair like x square minus y square here, and neighboring side I have z square orbital, then they are simply orthogonal, strictly orthogonal, because here I have sines plus plus minus minus, and here I have plus plus minus. So you see that these plus orbitals overlap equally well with plus lobes and minus lobes. So by symmetry, it's simply orthogonal. So this hopping between these two orbitals is simply zero. And that's actually what complicates the real calculation enormously, because I have to include all these orbital and directional dependence of this exchange of this hopping integral. That actually gives rise to this anisotropy in orbital sector. Now, then I have to put, say, u alpha beta, say, n I alpha sigma n I beta sigma prime. And the only restriction is that, say, alpha sigma is not equal to beta sigma prime. So I have the same orbital, but then it should be only spin up, spin down. Or if I have different orbitals, then maybe also parallel speeds. I can, in principle, include also Hund-Rolle coupling, like S orbital I, psi I, S on orbital J, or something like this. Or I can ignore it, because usually it's smaller. And then I can proceed in normal way, as we always do with strongly interacting Hubbard model. When I have u much larger than t, I use simply perturbation theory in t over u and obtain effective Hamiltonian, which is standard super-exchange Hamiltonian, which will, in this case, have a form containing not only spin operators. It will have J1 S dot S plus, in principle, J2 tau dot tau ij plus a mixture J3 SS tau tau. All for the same pair, ij, 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 ij. So this term coupled spin degrees of freedom and orbital degrees of freedom. It's not standard spin-orbit coupling, I want to stress. Standard spin-orbit coupling would correspond, which is L dot S. This is actually zero. In first approximation, it's quench for this orbital.
Is this term J3 of the same order as the other ones, or is it
all? It's the same order. Well, that actually will be one of the most important part of what I'm going to tell you. In principle, J1 are here of order of J2, of order of J3, or of them of order of T square over U. Plus, there are also some terms containing Hund-Rolle coupling. But in this approximation, they would be all of the same order. And that's very important. And another important thing is that, as you see from here, in spin sector, coupling is always simple Heisenberg-like, color product is U2. But in orbital sector, it's much more complicated. I don't write it in detail. But I can write you this corresponding interaction for one particular pair. And that's very easy to understand how it looks like. Suppose, again, I want to study this pair along z-axis. Then we know that if I have orbitals like this, they very strongly overlap. And finally, we know also the famous good enough Kanamori rules, which tells us that whenever the orbitals are directed toward one another, there will be strong anti-ferromagnetic exchange. However, if I will have one of the orbitals orthogonal, or if I have both orbitals orthogonal, there will be no coupling at all, or maybe very weak ferromagnetic coupling, only to the extent that I have Hund-Rolle coupling. And if I, for the beginning, ignore it, there will be simply zero, no coupling at all. So it means that my effective exchange interaction for this particular pair parallel to that will contain projection into spin singlet state, 1 quarter minus SISJ. So it project me to, or maybe I can write it down, 1/2 minus 2. So if spins are parallel, then it will be 0. If spins forming singlet, S dot S is minus 3/4, it will be just 1. But then it will exist only if both of these orbitals are tau z. So it means that I have projection 1/2 plus tau z i, 1/2 plus tau z j. And this will be my effective Hamiltonian, which will have a following form, maybe two. So for this particular phase, this is the form of effective Hamiltonian I have. So you see that it is scalar product in S, and it has terms which are also scalar product of tau z, only eigenterm, but also terms linear in tau z. And when I consider the same situation for the pair along x and y, I simply have to rotate, and this term will remain the same, and this tau z will go to this combination of the square root of 3 and so on. So that's simple rotation. So I explained to you very easily how to get this Hamiltonian. Actually, when we first obtained this Hamiltonian, it was quite a while ago together with Kugel, my first student. And we just did very elaborate job to get this Hamiltonian with calculating all the terms of perturbation theory and so on. But it's much simpler and it's very transparent actually this way. Simple projection operators by looking at this state projection to spin singlet and only to this particular occupation of orbital. And then again, you see that in orbital sector, if I rotate it, it will be rather strongly frustrated. And that was actually the reason of this claim of Feiner, Ohlers, and Zanon. In their PRL paper, actually, we already saw this degeneracy, this frustration long ago when we just studied this Hamiltonian, but then we added also some terms of order of, say, t square over u times Hund-Rule coupling over u. And these terms also leave the degeneracy. And then by this way, we managed to explain some real properties of some materials, like, say, for instance, potassium, copper, fluoride, or maybe even lanthanum, MnO3. Even without invoking any electron lattice interaction, we can obtain a correct spin and orbital structure in this case. And this was later on also confirmed by LDA calculations, LDA plus U, I think, calculation, also by Sasha Lichtenstein and Anisimov and Zanon. When even fixing the lattice as cubic or undistorted, they managed to obtain the correct orbital and spin ordering in LDA plus U. So this means that this electronic mechanism, exchange mechanism, electronic mechanism of orbital ordering is indeed very important and relevant. And it can give rise to orbital ordering even without real Jahn-Teller electron lattice interaction. So we may here speak about Jahn-Teller ordering without Jahn-Teller interaction due to electronic effect. Of course, if you release lattice later on, of course, it will adjust and it will still decrease energy still further. And very often, maybe it can also give rise to correct orbital structure itself. And that's actually the big open problem still until now. What is relative role in real materials like manganites, which is played by electron lattice interaction, standard Jahn-Teller interaction, and by this electronic effect. But with this electronic effect, there is also yet another interesting twist, which I said was started by this PRL paper, when Jan Zanon and co-workers, they claim that actually, in this particular situation, there may exist, because of this high frustration, there may exist situation with finite range of disordered state, which is spin in orbital liquid. What they did, they started by looking at this Hamiltonian, assuming certain particular ground state and calculating corresponding excitation spectrum. And the excitation spectrum, again, it turned out that it contains also mixed spin and orbital excitations. And the spectrum of this excitation, again, is gapless. It's mean field approximation again. And in mean field approximation is gapless. And not only is it gapless, but you start with cubic systems, and you calculate spectrum, and you obtain that the spectrum is gapless, and it has a gap along the whole line and spectrum. So it's kind of spectrum which looks like this. So spectrum becomes two-dimensional, essentially. gapless two-dimensional spectrum. And using Merman-Wagner arguments, we may say that if you have two-dimensional system with Goldstone spectrum, gapless spectrum, then your fluctuation will diverge. And that actually was the reason why they initially claimed, maybe because of this divergence, we may finally end up with a state which is completely disordered in both spins and orbital, spin orbital liquid. And then later on, it was refuted, or maybe there were some arguments that it may be not the case, but this will be order from disorder just in this model. That was actually the matter of this debate. Okay, now, I have to hide because I only just made very long introduction explaining where and how frustration appear in simple lattices. Now let's go to things which we did recently with geometrically frustrated lattices. Now maybe I will switch to this one, just that will be faster, and this part I already have more or less prepared. So this is the work which was done together with Maxim Mostovoy from our university. It's very good, increasing. The brightest guy I ever worked with. No, it's really true. It's really an incredibly good guy. And actually, this is a paper which we put it on the web, and it will be soon published in PRL, actually. It's accepted now. So now, we know that there exist many systems with more complicated lattices than perovskite. Okay, there was a pointer somewhere here. Okay? Cannot find it. Okay. Say, I don't see it here.
Yes.
Okay, here it is. So for instance, this famous spinel lattices, A, B2, O4, and B sides, octahedral sides, they form actually pyroclore lattices. That's a lattice of corner-shaped tetrahedra. And in this B side, you can put also these Jahn-Teller ions, which would have not only spin degeneracy, but also orbital degeneracy, maybe double orbital degeneracy. And from point of view of this possible orbital ordering, in two sublattices, it will be frustrated. And please note right away that actually situation is different also in other respect. Whereas in perovskites, we always had situation when we have two transition metal and oxygen in between, more or less in between, with 180 metal oxygen metal bond. Here we have 90 metal oxygen metal bond, 90 degree. From here to this oxygen and to this metal, or from to this oxygen and to this metal, or from here to this oxygen to this metal, it's 90 degree. So they are very different in this respect also. Now, we may also, for instance, take away one of these atoms, for instance, this atom and this atom, and then we will be left with these shaded triangles, and they will form sometimes triangular, sometimes Kagame lattices, and this is actually situation which we have in lithium-nickel O2. So how lithium-nickel O2 is formed? That's very simple situation. We start with nickel O, which is simple sodium chloride rock salt structure. Alternation of metal, oxygen, oxygen are all with green here, yeah, okay? And then you substitute half of nickel by lithium. And if we are lucky, if we can prepare sample carefully enough, then they order in planes perpendicular to 111 diagonal, 111 planes. So this will be nickel, nickel, nickel. Next 111 plane parallel to this one will be this lithium plane. So finally, we will end up with a plane, two-dimensional plane of nickels. And each nickel, as I mentioned, has low spin that's established by magnetic measurements. And it has S equal 1/2 and double degenerate orbital here. That's coordination. So it will be two-dimensional triangular lattice, and next layer will be lithium, and then again next layer will be nickel, so they will be well separated. So we end up with two-dimensional triangular lattice. And that's why, as I mentioned, when Anderson first suggested his RVB idea, people immediately started to look at this material and found out that indeed it looks as though it is magnetic. There is transmissibility follows Curie law. Curie Weiss law, this chi minus 1 over t, it's like this. So intercept seems to be ferromagnetic, but it does not order magnetically. So this is already first kind of disappointment, because if intercept is ferromagnetic, then it's not really anti-ferromagnetic to dimensional lattice, which you would like to have for RVB, but it's rather ferromagnetic coupling. But still there is no ordering, and not only that, but there is also no distortion, no structural distortion. Although formally speaking, you may expect that there should be also something connected with this orbital degeneracy, which should be lifted, and then this should give rise to distortion of the crystal. And it seems that it doesn't happen also in this lithium nickel at all. And then there have been many attempts and many suggestions to use this kind of description. People claimed, for instance, that, okay, which we use this kind of description with coupled spin and orbital degrees of freedom, and if all the parameters are equivalent, more or less of the same order, then we may end up here in spin orbital liquid, and that may be the reason why there is no observable magnetic ordering and observable distortion. So people use a lot this particular model, or even sometimes more symmetric version of this model. More symmetric version of this model is here it is. More symmetric version of this spin orbital model would be if I have Heisenberg-like interaction in spin sector and also Heisenberg interaction and Heisenberg-like interaction in orbital sector. Or I can write it down as, say, SS plus tau tau plus 4 SS tau tau. Then this will be SU2 symmetric. This will be also SU2. So you may think that it's SU2 cross SU2 symmetry, but it's even higher symmetry. It actually happens to be SU4 symmetry. So that's all spin in orbital sector and all mixing are all equivalent. And there will be a lot of, it's very nice theoretical model, toy model, and people just can solve it exactly in 1D case. And people claim that it may be relevant for this lithium nickel O2. And now we just started to look at this problem, in particular in connection with experiment of sodium analog of this material, which does show both Jan-Teller ordering and magnetic ordering. And we wanted to understand what's really going on. And first, we simply looked at what is real exchange in this case. And it turns out that actually you cannot use this model for this particular situation. It's simply wrong. You have to obtain correct effective Hamiltonian. And the main reason, in first moment at least, it seemed to us that the main reason is simply just this 90-degree exchange. That's the fact that I have the following situation. I have metal here with different possible orbital occupation, another metal here with different possible orbital occupation, and I have oxygen sitting here. But please note that whereas in a standard situation, when I have metal here, oxygen here, and metal here, then actually real hopping between these two transition metals occurs via oxygen p orbital. So for instance, this is d orbital of metal, d orbital of another metal. And we write down this Hamiltonian as T, say, ij, C dagger, I, Cj, sigma, sigma. But of course, real hopping occurs not because of direct overlap between these d orbitals, but via hopping through intermediate oxygen via the same orbital of intermediate oxygen. And then we exclude this oxygen, and we obtain effective DD model. Now, here we cannot do it simply, because different orbitals overlap with different oxygen orbitals, which are orthogonal. For instance, red orbital of this guy overlap with PZ orbital, red orbital in oxygen, and similar blue orbital directed towards this guy overlap with different orbital here. So this red is orthogonal to this blue. And this changes physics a lot. So to first approximation, actually, when there occurs virtual hopping, say electron hops from here to here, and then another electron hops from here to here, and then back, that's actually what happens. This will be, in effect, fourth order in TPD hopping. That's what we all know, actually. Actually, this PD model or three-band model is very popular now, because it's now widely used for cuprate superconductors. People, when people sometimes go beyond standard Hubbard treatment and include in apparent way oxygen orbitals. And here it will give rise to the fact that in first approximation, as you see, this hopping doesn't care about spin if there is no coupling, if there is no Hund-Rule coupling. Spins don't matter. Orbital occupation does matter, because if I have, for instance, occupation of a red orbital, there is one probability to hop here. If they have occupied a green orbital, it's a different probability. So orbital occupation does matter, but spin does not. And we can obtain effective Hamiltonian. And in real life, actually, this hopping occurs via two routes. Usually we have this plaquette when we have metal, oxygen, metal, oxygen. So metal, oxygen, metal, oxygen. So there is one route through this orbit path and one route through this path. And this gives rise actually to a different orbital. Suppose that, again, there's a sort of frustration. Suppose that orbital wants to be directed toward oxygen, like this. But from point of view of this neighbor, they want to be like this. And again, you see this kind of conflicting tendencies here. But finally, we can just go through all these things, and we obtain, finally, effective Hamiltonian. If there will be S type of orbitals, of course, there will be the same as standard Hubbard model, generally speaking. But P, well, P exchange seems to be more important, and it's usually included always.
No, but you have additional smallness of this Hund's rule over U.
Yeah, well, for spin or for spin coupling, maybe it's relevant. But for orbital ordering, in the first approximation, we obtain terms which couple only orbitals, which will be, again, of the same order as we should have, t squared, which was TDD squared. And in TPD, it will be fourth order. T fourth, that's T is TPD.
Can I ask you, sorry, I'm
okay.
Sorry. If I put myself on the oxygen,
okay.
I don't see a cubic field, right? Because I have Magellan on one side and lithium on the other.
Yeah, there is some trigonal splitting here,
right.
Definitely.
So why should you choose those oxygen? You're just putting yourself on...
No, there is trigonal splitting, definitely. And this may be, I don't know how important this is actually. It seems to be very small. And this should destroy...
Just if you say that you choose this PD sigma coupling, because you said on the oxygen, or you're putting yourself on the nail, and then you see that sits in a cubic field, so the oxygen should, but maybe the oxygen still put themselves like that, but they could put themselves like this, because the oxygen does not see a cubic field, so there's no reason why
you should go... If there is strong splitting, if there is strong splitting of p orbitals on oxygen due to this trigonal component of crystal field, then of course there may be some modification, and actually there was... After we just put this paper on the web, there was one paper from people from Marseille who just studied this problem and just claimed that if the splitting is very large, it can modify somewhat the conclusion. Yeah, indeed. I may just tell you about this a bit later. But first approximation, at least, it seems that this octahedra is quite regular. And this trigonal distortion of octahedra, which would really just be a signal of this trigonal crystal field. The change of angles, 111, trigonal distortion along 111. This seems to be rather small here.
Yeah, but I'm saying that's right. If you see the transition metal, you see these.
No. And it will be also, if there is strong trigonal field on oxygen, it will be also manifested in some distortions. And these distortions, trigonal distortions, are pretty weak here. In any case, if we just take this simple approximation, we obtain for each particular pair effective interaction, which includes only orbitals and which includes some particular combination of these orbitals. For instance, for pair along z, it will be alpha is x, y, z. And when alpha is x, y, z, then I have, say, I can introduce this effective combination of, just for simplicity, iz is my format tau z, which describes z square orbital. Ix is this crazy combination with square root of 3 and so on, but the orbital which creates x square orbital, and iy create y orbitals. And they are not linearly independent because the sum of them should be 0. So actually there are only two independent parameters, but it's convenient simply to simplify description to write them on like this, because I have x, y, z axis. And we can write down effective Hamiltonian. Maybe it's not really worthwhile to go into all the formal details how it looks like. But the bottom line is the following, that it looks as rather highly frustrated Hamiltonian, and it contains only orbital degrees of freedom. And spin coupling may appear, it does appear, but in higher order because it always contains Hund's rule coupling. Without Hund's rule coupling, we will have only orbital ordering, but no spin coupling whatsoever. And if we go on, then we obtain that the spin coupling is always ferromagnetic, whatever I do with orbitals. People really thought initially that, okay, fine, it may be that depending on the orbital occupation, sometimes I have ferrocoupling, sometimes I have anti-ferrocoupling. And that was suggested actually for lithium nickel too by Kitaoka and by some other people, also a group from Marseille. They claim that, okay, probably they claim the following. It looks as though lithium nickel O2 is both spin and orbital liquid. There is no orbital ordering. It means that orbitals are one moment like this, next moment like this, and so on. And they saw that, depending on that, sometimes I will have ferrocoupling, sometimes I will have anti-ferrocoupling. And it will be indeed the case in cubic perovskite. If I have these orbitals, it will be strongly anti-ferro. If I have this orbital, it will be ferro. So the sign of exchange may fluctuate together with fluctuation of orbital. However, it's not the case here. Because of 90-degree geometry, whatever I do with orbitals, spin coupling will be always ferromagnetic. Maybe weak, but ferromagnetic. And then I am in trouble, actually. I can explain this behavior of susceptibility, this ferromagnetic coupling, but why there is no long-range order in lithium-nickel O2, I do not know. What we did, actually, after we obtained this effective Hamiltonian, I can explain also there is very interesting physics in it, why it has such particular form, but probably I have no time.
Doesn't this geometry have a spin rate expression, partly 1D spin rate expression?
No, I will tell you just about spin rate dispersion in a moment. But not spin rate dispersion, but first of all, let's just finish with orbitals. And with orbitals, as I mentioned, we obtained correct Hamiltonian. We believe that it's correct Hamiltonian, which is much different from old things which we did with Kugel and perovskite. So the lesson number one, you have to be careful to apply these models to real material, because even the form of Hamiltonian may be quite different. Whereas in perovskite, we have spin and orbital and mixed term all of the same order. Here they are not. Spins and orbitals are decoupled. Orbital interaction is much stronger and frustrated. Spin interaction is always ferromagnetic. That's the message. Now, what to do with orbitals in this frustrated case? On the mean field level, again, we obtained that in this triangular lattice, there are many equivalent states. For instance, there may be ferro ordering of these pseudo-spins, isotopic spins, so to say. But on this particular line, I can rotate in on a cone, and mean field energy does not care, doesn't depend on that. And also, we calculated orbital wave spectrum, and it's degenerate, and it's also low-dimensional. We have two-dimensional system, but spectrum is one-dimensional. So it's huge fluctuation. And we may also...
It's always true when you have a finite
charge tetrahedra, right? It's a general property.
At least it's definitely true in this triangular system. It's not Kornachet in this case. This is actually, okay, if we consider a real octahedra, then octahedra have common H, two common oxygens. But triangles formed by these magnetic ions, they're also not only having one common corner like in Kagamelites, but you see each triangle has many neighboring triangles. In Kagame it would be only one common corner between triangles. Here it's not the case. But in any case, again, the message that we went through all this mathematics and calculated spin wave spectrum. It's rather funny, actually, this is orbital wave spectrum, sorry. And it's gapless and it's low dimensional. Here it is, how it looks like. And then we had to go beyond this mean field, and we obtained that if we go beyond mean field, then due to order by disorder phenomenon, there will be one particular orbital ground state chosen, which corresponds to ferro orbital ordering. All orbitals are parallel. That's what we do expect in this particular case if we do it right. And not playing with toy models like SU4.
You just do one loop calculation on that.
Well, that actually was done in this kind of one loop calculation, essentially. Yeah. And then the gap which opens is of this order. So it's of order of, say, exchange coupling times this square root of Hopkins. So final message is that we would obtain here, once again, that orbital detection is much stronger than spin one. There will be a long-range, or we do expect that there will be a long-range ordering of ferrotype, and magnetic exchange is always fair. Now we can compare real materials and see whether our predictions are kind of reasonable or not. And here there are two materials, lithium nickel two and sodium nickel two. And in lithium nickel two, there is no orbital ordering, although there is something happening at about this temperature, because by EXAFS, which measures local distortions, people claim that they do see some local distortions of octahedra, but they are not ordered in coherent way and cooperatively. Now, there is no spin detected spin ordering, but in very recently, just last year, when people finally managed to prepare good samples, completely or almost completely stoichiometric, they obtained something like spin glass transition at about 8 or 9 Kelvin.
Do you think that the upper one is the orbital glass?
Which one?
The upper one.
This one?
Yeah, the T0 star, is that the orbital glass?
That I don't know really. I don't know. That's actually still a problem for me. I don't know. That may be still fluctuating orbitals, but why? I don't understand really. But there exists another material, sodium nickel two, which is formally made exactly in the same way. It's also one layer, triangular layer of nickel and one layer of sodium. And this one behaves in a quite decent way, normal way. So it has rather strong distortion with ferro orbital ordering with this high transition temperature. So it has some extra. If you start with cubic lattice, if you treat it as cubic, then it would have tetragonal. And there is already, of course, this trigonal field to start with. So trigonal plus tetragonal, finally, it gives you monoclinic distortion. But OK, fine. But the distortion connected with this ordering signals that all orbitals are parallel, for instance, along z-axis in this crystal. And then it has antiferromagnetic spin ordering, but antiferromagnetic spin ordering made in such a way that the triangular layers I told you about are ferro. But next triangular layer is opposite to it. So it's what we call A-type antiferromagnetic. So there is no net moment, but each layer is indeed ferromagnetic and transition temperature 20 Kelvin. And if you estimate this theta from the slope of susceptibility, it's say 30 something. So that's pretty reasonable agreement. And so this guy is behaves exactly as we expected to do. So what really happens with lithium, nickel, or two? I have no final answer. There are some material problems, actually, which may be relevant to this thing. The point is that sodium and nickel are have pretty different sizes. Sodium is much bigger than nickel. And if you want to order them in consecutive planes, usually it helps a lot. So if ions have comparable or similar, the same sizes, then they usually substitute one another. And it's known that in sodium, it's indeed quite stoichiometric, and ordering is almost perfect in one layer. Lithium and nickel 3+, low spin nickel 3+, are almost the same size. And also, people say that when they prepare the samples, it's usually slightly non-stoichiometric.
Has anyone done the EXAF studies to determine member parameters?
Well, EXAF studies have been done in lithium nickel O2, and they claim that actually there is this local Jantelier distortion. But as to neighbors of different kinds, people didn't really just study it in this way. But usually what people claim that we have, say, for instance, lithium 1 minus x, nickel, say, maybe, or maybe 1 plus x even, or 2, or maybe something like this. So we have some, usually some deficiency of lithium and so on. So it's very difficult to make it stoichiometric. And even if it's stoichiometric, sometimes you may have a situation when you have nickel in the wrong places, in the lithium planes. And then what happens, it was suggested by some experimentalists from Grenoble, it may very strongly frustrate your coupling between the layers. So that's kind of illustrated here, more or less. Suppose I have this triangular layer of nickel. This is supposed to be lithium layers, white circles. This is again nickel. And this wants to be ferromagnetic, and this wants to be opposite to it. And if I have magnetic nickel here, then it has very strong magnetic coupling both here and here. You can see if you just look at this crystal structure, then we can realize that coupling between these guys goes via 90-degree oxygen bond. So that's rather weak. But coupling from here to this nickel and to this one goes via 180-degree bond. So this coupling between this extra nickel in the wrong place and magnetic planes is very strong and anti-ferromagnetic. So suppose that this is up, this is down. But then this will be also wants to be up and rather strongly, whereas in the rest of the sample it wants to be down. So this extra nickel in the wrong place will not really do much as to this exchange interaction in the plane, but it will strongly frustrate coupling between layers. So this can explain in principle why we don't have a proper long-range magnetic order in lithium nickel O2, but we may have spin glass instead. And that's actually what people did see very recently. But it still doesn't solve all the problem, because I can explain by these impurities, and small amount of these impurities, 1%, will be enough, really. But I can explain the absence of magnetic ordering. But why there is no cooperative Jantelier distortion, I don't know. Because if I put a very small amount of these guys here, but if there is strong tendency to ferro orbital ordering all over the place, and this may also ferro orbitally order and so on. So why this one is suppressed, for instance, if it's indeed suppressed by disorder? I don't know. No idea. I simply don't know. And there may be also some other things in this game, because lithium nickel O2 has rather relatively small energy gap, about 0.2 electron volt. So maybe that's also one of the reasons why it's different. Sodium nickel O2 has a gap of about 1 electron volt. It's pretty good insulator, so all these considerations really are okay for it. Lithium nickel O2 is much closer to a metal. Maybe this is relevant. Another point which may be important is also that when people are speaking about high valence state, nickel 3+, it may well be that it's not, strictly speaking, a good notion. So like in cuprate, for instance, we start with copper, say lanthanum 2, copper O4, and doped by strontium, but we don't create copper 3 plus, but we rather create oxygen holes. There is a lot of action on oxygen. And it may be the same with nickel. So maybe what we call nickel 3 plus should be rather treated as nickel 2 plus and ligand hole. It may still have the same quantum numbers. So in that sense, actually, maybe a large part of what we did will still be okay. But, well, who knows? Maybe there will be some qualitative changes because of very large contribution of oxygen holes. Okay, I already spent slightly more than I'm supposed to do, and I can only make a claim. And the claim is, well, that we are just finishing, or almost finished this right now. But the claim is the following, that I have also some transparency, but probably I won't show it. If someone is interested, we can discuss it separately. But the claim is following. Again, let's go back to the beginning. We consider a situation with doubly degenerate orbitals, for instance, orbital ordering, and orbital degrees of freedom, spin degrees of freedom. And we just discussed initially what we will get if we proceed from a simple degenerate Hubbert model. If we proceed from the degenerate Hubbert model, what we end up with is this effective Hamiltonian, which contains term of, say, SS plus J2 tau tau plus J3 SS tau tau, and all of them J1 is of order of J2, of order of J3, of order of T square over U, dd. So you see that there would be very strong coupling between spin and orbital degrees of freedom. Now, then we just very recently we went to this 90 degree bonds. When I have oxygen here and transition metal here, transition metal here, and then we saw that we have to include in an apparent way oxygen p orbitals. We cannot really describe it by simple Hubbert model. We have to consider dp model, and the outcome was different. First of all, spin and orbitals were strongly decoupled, and then all the other consequences which we just discussed. Okay, fine. Another point which we can mention here is the following, that if I proceed from Hubbert model, there is electron hole symmetry in Hubbert model. So effective Hamiltonian for one electron and for one hole is exactly the same here. But it's not here, because in dp model, there is no electron hole symmetry anymore. Okay, fine, but now let's remember what did we learn in dealing with, say, cuprates and so on. There we learned, and actually it was known even before cuprate form, this famous work of Zanon, Zawadzki, and Allen, that there exist two types of insulators. One of them is called Mott-Hubbert insulator, but another is called charge transfer insulator. So if I have, say, D levels here and P oxygen levels here, and I denoted delta charge transfer, then depending on the ratio between delta charge transfer and U, okay, over T, for instance, just normalized, 1, 1, I have, in principle, two different regimes. If delta is very large, I can exclude my oxygen orbitals and go over to effective Hubbert model, and here it's Mott-Hubbert insulator. But here, my lowest excitations would be not excitation from D to D, but rather from D to P, from oxygen to transition metal. And this is what we called charge transfer excitation, charge transfer insulator. And the ground state is seems to be the same. It's also localized electrons, antiferromagnetic, but excitations are different. Single particle excitations are different. Okay, now we learned that in these 90 degree bonds, we have to include orbitals in apparent way. So now we went back to 180 degree to perovskite and started to look, okay, what happens if we are not in this regime, but in this regime? What would we get? And well, lo and behold, we found out that in this case, same as in 90 degree exchange, Also, this old thing which we did with Kugel isn't valid, doesn't work. It again is the same that electron hole symmetry is lost. Orbitals interaction is much stronger than spin, and well, here we go. So the same message which we learned kind of almost accidentally by looking at this 90-degree bond has probably much more, much bigger significance, more important. So it's in a sense, actually, it turns out that these two regimes have to be explained differently. They are explained almost the same way if we don't have orbital degeneracy. Then we have simple Heisenberg model. Without orbital degeneracy, both here and here, I have effective Hamiltonian, which is, say, again, say, TPD force divided by delta squared divided by UD. No, OK. Here it will be 1 over UD plus 1 over 2 delta plus UP times S dot S. So there are two terms, one of them describing virtual hopping to D electrons when I have extra electron, extra hole on D, and P oxygen, oxygen remains the same. Another when from oxygen I simultaneously move two holes, for instance, or two electrons to neighboring and back. OK, fine, but that's a slight modification of effective exchange coupling, but symmetry of ground state remains the same. And I actually thought a lot, is there any real difference between charge transfer and Mott-Hubbert insulator? There is definitely one in excitation spectrum, but what about ground state? And until recently, we always thought the ground state is exactly the same. And it is the same without orbital degeneracy. But with orbital degeneracy, it's not. It turns out that Mott-Hubbert insulator may have one type of orbital ordering, and the charge transfer regime, same material, may have different type of orbital and spin ordering. And that, I think, rather exciting, actually, rather interesting, because it was unexpected for me. I am in this game for quite a while, and I did not realize it. Although I thought, actually, whether there are any such cases, any such situations when these two states will be indeed different qualitatively. And here we found at least one such case when they are indeed seems to be different qualitatively. Now, as to the main point of what I was going to tell you about today, this is about frustration. Just a general conclusion is that there is definitely a very strong tendency to some frustrations, even in simple lattices like cubic or square lattices. And this tendency becomes much stronger, actually, if I have also geometric frustration. So this kind of two type of frustration, they kind of are on top of one another, and degeneracy and problem becomes much more severe in really frustrated lattices. So that's interesting problem in itself. Orbital ordering in frustrated lattices.
Which of these two models has more frustration for the same lattice, geometric lattice?
For the same lattice, actually, this is more frustrated. Because here I have decoupled spin and orbital degrees of freedom, so I have only one type of the dangerous excitations. Orbital sector is separate. And here, in this case, that's actually a situation which what Feiner, Euler, Zanon considered. I have several pseudo-Goldstone or Goldstone modes which couple together and which give you some extra degree of freedom. Well, actually, I must say that I have to be a bit careful with this statement. Maybe we have to look at it in more details. But at least my first impression is that this would be more frustrated, okay? Because of that, because they have two soft degrees of freedom, and here I have only one left because of this decoupling. Okay, but still, what happens in some of the situations, in particular also in this lithium-nickel O2, because of this frustration, it is, I would say that it's still a problem, because on one hand, we have this nice mechanism of order from disorder, and it works fine. But whether it's really well justified for spin 1/2 or pseudo-spin 1/2, it's still a problem. So could well be that this real quantum effect for only 1/2 spin or orbital 1/2 may still be strong enough to give you really some non-trivial ground state like spin and orbital. And that's actually why this link to the main activity of this workshop is For instance, I may be very much interested, as I mentioned, there are very different behavior of lithium nickel O2 and sodium lithium O2. So why? If we suspect that here these fluctuations are very strong, why they are much weaker here? And maybe in that sense, actually, some method like DMFT may help. That we discussed it here with Sasha Lichtenstein and Sasha Poterias. Maybe it's possible to make calculations for these two systems in parallel with the same approximation and see whether we'll see any difference, any indications of why they behave so differently. I don't really know yet. So there is still some puzzles in this lithium nickel O2. Okay, that's it. Thank you.